It is Monday, January 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. government is partially shut down for a third day. Turkey steps up an offensive against a Syrian Kurdish militia, and a new scientific tool may help diagnose disease. It's all ahead. The U.S. government is partially shut down for a third day on Monday, the start of a new work week, even as the Senate is set to vote at this hour on whether to end the stalemate among lawmakers over federal spending and immigration policies. The vote is on funding the government through February 8th, but the contentious issue protecting about 800,000 young illegal immigrants from deportation remain unresolved. I'm joined now by national correspondent Jim Malone. So, Jim, how is the debate on immigration affecting this current shutdown? Is that the main problem?
Yeah, this is the real point of contention. And, you know, to update what's going on at the moment, we're expecting this hour a vote, another attempt to reopen the government. There are some signs here that they may be able to get enough Democrats to join with Republicans in the Senate vote. They need 60 out of 100, that they may be able to actually reopen the government. Now, we don't want to get ahead of ourselves,
right?
But there are some signs, I think, that some of the Democrats believe perhaps their point has been made, and they want to avoid, you know, any more sort of political fallout from this. As I say, we have to wait for the vote to take place. As of right now, it hasn't even begun yet, and we're waiting to hear from the Senate leaders, both the Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, and the Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer. But there are some signs here that I think enough Democrats now might go over to the Republican side and support a reopening of the government, which would kick this whole issue down the road for another 3 weeks.
Well, that's been the problem, because we've really been going through this for the last several months. We haven't had a shutdown till now, but it's just been continually over the holidays it keeps on going.
Right, and this is Monday, the first start of the work week here in Washington and around the country. This is when you would start to see the more profound effects of the shutdown taking place. And look, it's a high-stakes gamble for both parties, for the president, you know, who gets the blame in these situations. And the longer it goes on, you know, that could affect one party or the other in a stronger way. But it does show you there's kind of this trust deficit in Washington right now, and we've seen it for years. But they're just struggling right now to even get for a few weeks time to do more talking about immigration. But we also have to say it just shows you what a divisive issue this can be, this immigration issue, specifically Democrats standing up for the people called the Dreamers, who were illegally brought here as children. And Republicans want a tougher line on immigration generally, and they want more border security. So these are the talking points, but right now both sides are trying to figure out if they can get the government reopened and then negotiate some more.
This is all occurring as the Trump administration is marking its 1 year, first year. I mean, what impressions can we draw about how this president functions? Because he's very active, of course, on Twitter, and he has been tweeting a lot, not just about this, but about so many of his policies.
He's been sitting back a bit during this shutdown crisis. He hasn't been that visible. He does take to Twitter on occasion. He hasn't really taken a leading role, but I think the Republicans feel they have a stronger position, so they don't feel they have to put him out there. But you're right. I mean, on the one-year anniversary, the government was shut down in a way that kind of encapsulates where the country has come under Donald Trump. He likes to boast about its achievements, especially on the economy, and yet those have not helped his poll ratings at all. So it's a very bifurcated situation politically. And the Democrats are gearing up for midterm congressional elections in November, where they hope to deliver a pretty stunning blow, perhaps even taking control of one of the two chambers, the House of Representatives. So the country is politically divided. We saw that not only with the one-year commemorations of the Trump anniversary, but Also, frankly, the women's marches around the country and even internationally this past weekend, which shows the divisions in our politics in stark relief to the point that it's even hard to keep the government functioning. So where we go from here, if they can get the government reopened, perhaps there's some glimmer of hope they can get talking about the substantive issues that keep them apart on immigration.
All right. Thanks very much, Jim. That's national correspondent Jim Malone. Well, joining me also here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. Well, Doug, I'm sure there's a lot of reaction on is it trending.
Jim Malone, always the optimist, I have to think. whatever happens today, obviously this is going to be a very short-term fix. He had mentioned the deficit of trust that seems to be pervade Washington these days. We're seeing this really pervade social media. And there's an interesting story here, but two of the big hashtags trending right now are hashtag Trump shutdown and hashtag Schumer shutdown. Of course, these are the two terms that the two parties have been kind of trying to negotiate and navigate, you know, pushing who's to blame, who's more at fault. So the Trump shutdown, these are people who are generally unhappy with the president. Let me get this straight. Angel Padilla writes, McConnell promised Susan Collins a vote on her Obamacare bill in exchange for her vote on taxes. She never got it, and now Dems are taking him at his word. So there again, the bit of that trust deficit. Someone tweeting here, Democrats must hold the line. They must hold the line for Dreamers. They must hold the line for millions of children that depend on CHIP. That's the child health program, insurance program. Let's see, and a lot of Congress members as well. Here's Joaquin Castro. In 2014, comprehensive immigration bill had votes to pass. Speaker Boehner, fearful of using his job, followed the Hastert rule, refused to put it to a vote. Then he quit his job next year. I hope Paul Ryan doesn't make the same mistake. Over at hashtag Schumer shutdown, you're seeing again a lot of politicians. James Woods, the famous actor, Governor Mike Huckabee, Laura Ingraham, but a lot of people just kind of saying, you know, here's, for example, fact, the majority of Americans think approving a budget to stop a government shutdown should be a bigger priority for Congress than passing a bill to fix DACA. The American people have spoken. Ball's in your court, Senate Democrats. Now, interestingly, you would think that these just kind of are fighting it out amongst themselves, and people are, you know, taking to social media to just sort of vent their frustration at Washington. There is research out today, however, that the hashtag Schumer shutdown is being massively tweeted and retweeted by Russian bots. Oh. These are the same bots that put out all kinds of what look like people's personal opinions and whatnot, but it's just auto-generated stuff that kind of fills up social media space to make people kind of think, oh, well, gosh, I guess a lot of people agree with me, or a lot of people are thinking this, and of course, it gets shared around. The Russian bots now are, there's a project run by the German Marshall Fund think tank that is tracking this, and they say they've seen a 200,000% increase. How about that? In Russian bot activity, and specifically using one of them, the hashtag Schumer shutdown. So yet again, just a reminder that just because something's floating around out there doesn't mean it's necessarily what you may think it is.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories trending. The International Monetary Fund says global economic growth is getting stronger, but risks remain. Vice President Mike Pence says the U.S. Embassy will move to Jerusalem in 2019. The beginning of the Rohingya repatriation to Myanmar has been delayed, and George Weah is sworn in as Liberia's president. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA. This is International Edition. Turkish forces shelled northern Syria on Monday, pressing a campaign to push Kurdish militia out of the Afrin area, while officials said the operation will be over quickly. The Kurdish militia YPG also reported clashes Monday with Turkish forces northwest of Afrin. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council was to take up Turkey's incursion into Afrin province to eliminate what it perceives as a threat by the Kurdish YPG militia. Ankara views the YPG as an extension of the outlawed Kurdish Workers' Party, or PKK, separatist organization. The U.S. has called for restraint and urges Turkey and its Free Syrian Army rebel allies to limit the scope and duration of Operation Olive Branch and avoid civilian casualties. Turkey, a NATO ally, informed Washington prior to launching the offensive Saturday. Ankara hopes to create a 30-kilometer deep safe zone in northern Syria. James Jeffrey is a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute on Near East Policy and a former regional diplomat. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty these are not the Kurdish units backed by the U.S.
The point is the U.S. has made it clear that it has never had a relationship with or helped train or worked with or done operations with this YPG element in the northwest of Syria and Afrin. And that also is an area where the Turks have had numerous attacks across the border because the YPG is an offshoot of the PKK. So the U.S. is essentially distancing itself from that particular group of the YPG. It sees this as a distraction, but it's not a major development. It's not going to change anything significant on the ground except perhaps give the Turks a bit more of a buffer between the Turkish border and these YPG people.
Well, what rebels are the U.S. backing?
The U.S. is backing a YPG element in the northeast of the country that has been fighting ISIS. But it's backing it on the basis of tactical and, if you will, transactional purposes to defeat ISIS and to help the U.S. stay on the ground, because the U.S. now has a new goal, which is quasi-official, of trying to contain Iran. That's where it gets complicated. The Turks don't like the people in the northeast either.
This is opening up a new front in this seven-year conflict.
It's not a new front because, I mean, the main conflict on the ground in Syria has been between the Syrian opposition and Assad, Iran, and Russia, with the U.S. and Turkey and the Arab states at various points more or less supporting the opposition. Then the second front was, of course, the U.S.-led campaign against ISIS, which occasionally the Russians and Assad and Iran would join in on. The ISIS campaign is pretty much finished, but now the United States is moving in a different direction to try to contain Iran. That was the point of Rex Tillerson's speech back on Wednesday of this week. The problem is the Turks have a real security concern with the YPG, and we haven't sorted that out yet. Not so much where the Turks are going in now, but in the area where we have American forces in the northeast of the country.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis on Sunday on a trip to Asia said that the U.S. was notified by Turkey ahead of the airstrikes in Syria. Mattis in his comments said Turkey has legitimate security concerns.
And he's right.
And that has to do with these sporadic attacks into Turkish territory?
They particularly have come from the Afrin area. I know that area very well. It's mountainous terrain that runs across the border into Turkey and then down to the sea near the ports of Iskenderun and Mersin. That has been a route that the PKK, this Turkish insurgent group of which the PYD is a Syrian offshoot, has been able to infiltrate and attack Turkish forces repeatedly in that area.
That's James Jeffrey of the Washington Institute on Near East Policy. Afghan government forces ended an overnight siege Sunday at Kabul's Intercontinental Hotel that resulted in multiple deaths and injuries. At least 14 foreign nationals are said to be among the victims. The siege lasted nearly 14 hours, during which six assailants either blew themselves up or were gunned down by Afghan forces. Reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad, Pakistan, describes to me the circumstances surrounding the attack.
It has surprised many people, not only in Afghanistan, but outside the country, that how deeply rooted the Taliban are currently in the system, because attacking an international hotel like this Intercontinental Hotel in Kabul, which is run by the state of Afghanistan, is not easy, but still these five attackers in army uniform were able to storm the hotel. But let me just quickly tell you that the weapons that they use, heavy and light machine guns and explosives, all the stuff was actually already taken into the kitchen maybe a few days back before the attack. And they entered, they picked up the stuff, and then they started indiscriminately firing at guests inside hotel in different parts.
Yes, that is very disturbing, and I'm sure an investigation is underway, but that they could bring all these weapons and then, you know, to a location in the kitchen, and they were able to leave them there for a few days before the attack happened.
That is true, because the question which is being raised again and again over the last 2 days is that this is a hotel being run by the government of the state of Afghanistan, but just a few weeks ago, its security was contracted to a private security firm. And that's why it is raising a lot of questions, that the suspicions are on members of that firm, that how come a private company was allowed to, was given security responsibility of a hotel where all the time there are foreign guests, there are rich Afghan businessmen staying here. And that's why, and it is located in a very, in a highly secured part of Kabul. So how come, this is the question being raised, that a private company was given the responsibility to offer security to this facility.
Well, as you said, the Taliban have claimed responsibility for the attack. Is it known whether an ally of the Taliban, the Haqqani Network, is it known at all yet whether they were involved in the attack as well?
But we're still waiting for officials to come out with some clues about their investigation, because for the last 2 days, not a single reporter or media outlet has been allowed to really visit the site and see for themselves what happened inside the hotel. But the Afghan Interior Ministry was quick, just hours after the attack, to blame the Haqqani Network, which is the allied with the Taliban. But again, that also raises questions that if the attackers so easily went into the hotel and with so much heavy weapon and light machine guns available to them inside the kitchen, if they were not able to look detect them, how come that they were so quick in identifying the plotters of this attacker? So again, as of today, there's no significant advancement as far as the investigation goes, but these are the questions which are being asked by the local media, by all the commentators, that attack this holding responsible some group, or whether it's Islamic State or Haqqani Network or the Taliban, is one thing. But how come they were able to penetrate deep into these security layers that are around the facilities in Kabul, like the Intercontinental Hotel?
Reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad, Pakistan. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. While ultrasounds and x-rays help physicians diagnose everything from breast cancer to kidney stones, those scans cannot reveal what is inside the masses. Having that immediate knowledge could help millions of patients avoid unneeded stress and surgery. As Erica Celeste reports, groups at both Purdue and Boston universities are developing technology that will be able to provide that internal view.
Dr. Jishin Cheng has devoted his life's work to something that, until now, has sounded a lot like science fiction. He and his team have developed several medical tools that help diagnose patients using sound and light.
We want to make a device like the tricorder in that Star Trek. So the dream, our dream is to make a scientific movie into a real practice.
In the science fiction Star Trek series, the tricorder is waved over a patient to collect information.
Rizzo's alive. Well, your Vulcan metabolism is so low it can hardly be measured.
In conventional medicine, surgeons must either cut out the suspect tissue for analysis or risk exposing already very sick patients to fluorescent dyes and nanoparticles. These so-called labels light up lesions so doctors can study them. Team member Jesse Vang explains their technique, called label-free imaging, eliminates more invasive or toxic procedures by bouncing light off molecules in the tumor.
We do not need labeling, so we can basically look at the vibrations of the molecules, and these vibrations can generate signals in our microscope.
Those vibrations serve as molecular fingerprints unique to each type of molecule. The patterns can be mapped to identify such things as lipids, proteins, and nucleic acid. In essence, the devices give doctors the ability to look at a patient in three instead of two dimensions.
We can see if the patient has a cancer, which usually accumulate a lot of lipids.
The label-free imaging devices have shown promise in identifying kidney, liver, and breast cancer. One device, the Margin PAT, funded by the National Institute of Health, will also help breast cancer surgeons remove tumors more efficiently and accurately. In the United States, about a quarter of all breast cancer patients must undergo a second surgery to remove missed malignant cells. The developers expect Margin PAT will dramatically reduce that number. Chang and his partner, Dr. Pu Wang, founded Vibronix to manufacture the device. Wang says it could revolutionize medicine around the world.
In China, the medical practice is not as good as the tier one hospital. So those surgeons can use the setup to perform the similar surgery or provide the care as exactly the same quality as the first tier surgeons.
If all goes as planned, the Margin PAT will be on the market within 3 years, and several more of Chang's label-free imaging devices won't be far behind, making his dream for a real Star Trek tricorder one step closer to reality. For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in West Lafayette, Indiana.
Positive news for patients. Well, that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States will maintain a military and diplomatic presence in Syria in order to help achieve a stable, unified, and independent Syria, said U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. Now Syria remains a source of severe strategic and diplomatic challenges. The United States, he declared, will maintain a military deployment to ensure the lasting defeat of ISIS and Al-Qaeda. More broadly, the United States will remain engaged, he declared, to protect our security interests, which require several outcomes in addition to the enduring defeat of ISIS and Al-Qaeda. The resolution of the conflict between the Assad regime and the Syrian people through the UN-led political process prescribed in Security Council Resolution 2254, leading to a post-Assad leadership that can run a functioning state. Conditions that allow refugees and internally displaced persons to begin safely returning to Syria, a Syria free of weapons of mass destruction, and the diminishment of Iranian influence in Syria. Secretary Tillerson pointed out that the Iranian regime has long dreamed of creating a northern arch stretching from Iran to Lebanon and the Mediterranean. To that end, it has dramatically strengthened its presence in Syria through the deployment of IRGC troops and support for Hezbollah and other proxies.
Through its position in Syria, Iran is positioning to continue attacking U.S. interests, our allies, and personnel in the region. It is spending billions of dollars a year to prop up Assad and wage proxy wars at the expense of supporting its own people.
If the United States were to disengage from Syria, Iran would be given the opportunity to further strengthen its position. As a destabilized nation and one bordering Israel, Syria presents an opportunity that Iran is all too eager to exploit, Mr. Tillerson said. The U.S. plans to help stabilize Syrian territory liberated from ISIS and assist in setting the conditions conducive to the implementation of the UN-led political process. This will support the establishment of a democratic Syrian government not under the control of Assad, which would go a long way toward reducing and expelling malicious Iranian influence from Syria. A stable, unified, independent Syria will serve the national interests of the United States, its allies, and our partners, said Secretary Tillerson. If that reality can come to pass, it will be a victory for all, and it will support the ability of the Syrian people to pursue their own God-given rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.